What sparked your passion for cooking?
I have a good appetite and I eat.
I'll often make subtle changes to the next batch of it.
As long as it has room to move around, it's classified as free range.
So my mother gave me a crash course in cookery when I was 16.
I remember sampling this amazing drink, thinking how I've never tasted coffee this good.
Which homemade desserts can be cheaper than shop-bought alternatives?
We want people to feel at home.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour, your fortnightly food and drink programme for Cambridge. I'm Matt Bentman.
I'm Ruth Reyes.
And I'm Alan Alder. And many thanks to Brian O'Reilly for the last 2 hours of barbecue-related music. And now it's time for more food.
It's been an amazing fortnight with Eat Cambridge's third Festival of Food and Drink and Camera's 42nd Cambridge Beer Festival.
And we've had an interesting time ourselves. I've been to the Anglia Farm Shop where, as well as having a bleating good time, I found out about goats and goat meat.
I've been to Cherry Hinton to revisit Rhode Island, which opened about a year and a half ago and has received some very good plaudits for its food and drink.
And on the subject of drink, Alice Archer returns for her monthly stint about wine. Pinot Noir, in fact, the grape of choice. We also have a feature on beer and ale in the 16th century.
And on the subject of food and drink history, Andrew Webb's historical bookshelf today looks at a couple of volumes from the 60s and 70s that cast their eye over what was on offer here in Cambridge in those days.
And in a more up-to-date note, we'll be bringing you the food and drink news for the next couple of weeks at the end of the programme.
So let's move on to our first feature. According to meatgoatblog.com, which I'm sure we all follow assiduously, according to it, almost three quarters of the world's population eat goat meat. And this makes the UK really something of an anomaly because we favour beef, pork, lamb and chicken. But over the last few decades, the US has caught on to goat farming, thanks in part to the introduction of the hardy boar goat breed. And boars are proliferating here too, in Cambridge as it happens. And in response, Matt went along to visit a local goat farm with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
It's more of a way of life. You're never going to be a millionaire raising goats, but I think they're lovely animals. So long as you're not too uncomfortable about it, they're also very tasty.
Goat meat is featuring a lot in the media these days. It's one of the big food trends of the year. Barbecue goat meat featured on BBC's Countryfile last month. It was also on Celebrity MasterChef, Come Dine With Me, and it's finding its way into many top restaurants, and it's favoured because it braises fantastically, it grills like a joy, and it roasts splendidly. Now, these are the words of Fergus Henderson from St John's Restaurant in Spitalfields, London. Today, I'm in a field in Cambridge on a licensed goat farm talking with Melanie Onura and her husband John and their friend Sarah. And Melanie, how big is the herd that you have here?
In total, we've got nearly 50 goats and 25 of them or so are kids and the rest are the breeding herd. My grandparents farmed back in Norfolk. They had sheep and pigs, geese, arable farming. But yeah, this is my first proper experience farming.
All right, give me a show of hands. How many of you consider yourself commercial goat producers, or that's where your interest lies?
I was in.
You're right.
It's a big idea.
Goat meat is. I think traditionally we've had a strong liking for. We had to go into London to get goat meat. So we opted to get a small holding. I said, let's give it a try and have a few goats, see what it looks like. This was 7 years ago, and here we are now. So far, so good. The children have been helpful too.
Yeah, really.
How would I say the level of help?
Yeah, our daughter's been really brilliant. She's very good. Good at giving injections, hoof trimming, castrating, birthing.
Hands-on.
Hands-on.
Yeah. Yes.
Castrating and hoof trimming isn't easy. I have trouble.
No. No, they don't offer themselves.
When this all started and went online, we just couldn't keep up with the demand for fresh goat meat. But it is there. It is there. A lot of people travelling overseas and want to come back home and try out their experiences in, you know, North Africa and Caribbean. Where I come from, Nigeria, lamb is a more high-profile meat. Goat is more of a traditional staple meat. Much easier, much hardier animals.
Now, a goat farm is not like a sheep farm or a cow farm. Goats are much more inquisitive, they're very athletic, they're quite mischievous. They need a level of entertainment, of interest, much like a sheepdog does.
I would say that they're pretty smart, yeah. They like to run, jump, play, climb things, get into trouble. They like a routine. They do know that when I turn up at the gate, food is coming.
I think it's probably based on the size of their stomachs. If they've been very well fed and they see you passing by, they'll just have a little wave. But if it's food time and their bellies are empty, then they go for it, you know. So.
I think mine know the sound of my car.
Okay,
they know the sound of my car, and as soon as they hear that, they come up.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I come up in a different car, I don't see them, and then suddenly they're like, oh, you're here.
Oh,
surprise.
<okay. laughs>
So no, they're very intelligent, I think.
This breed is the
boar.
The boar.
Yes, they really are the meat breed because they are much stockier and are going to produce more meat than a dairy goat would.
If there's only one thing that you take away from here, I'd like for it to be this. The most important aspect of meat goat production is reproductive efficiency. It's going to affect your bottom line more than any other possible thing.
So normally when goats have a kid in the first year of producing, they normally only have one, just a singleton baby.
Okay.
And then subsequent years they have twins and triplets. And that's what we've been experiencing on our farm until about 6 or 7 days ago.
Yeah.
One of the first-time mums had quads. I think she was in shock. I was in shock. I phoned my neighbour and said, oh, please, could you come over and help? I can't carry four kids and look after the mum, take them all into the kidding shed together. So, yeah, we've had a really fabulous week looking after quads.
And this is her, one of the quads asleep on your arm here.
Yes, I think she's looking pretty happy and quite comfortable. Full tummy. Oh, gosh, and even a little smile.
It's the sound of two very hungry baby goats at feeding time. It may not be obvious, but there's a little bit of an art to this, isn't there? Because you hold the bottle at a certain angle so that the air bubbles don't travel through and make the baby burp too much.
Yes.
You have to hold the bottle almost upright because it has to represent the udder.
Okay, well done. Let me...
It does.
So it's been covered a lot in the media about how goat meat is gaining popularity, and I just wondered how you're gauging it yourselves. You know, is the market changing?
Yeah, I think we can see quite a big increase in demand. People are much more interested in eating goat meat. Celebrity chefs have been cooking it on television. Lots of people, more people are talking about it. Newspapers, I think, have been giving out, printing recipes that people might enjoy.
Mm.
And like John was saying before, you know, as we're travelling more into kind of Europe, Asia, customers have been telling us, yes, we had goat meat on holiday. Can we buy some of yours? We'd love to, you know, try and cook some up at home.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's becoming much more popular, yeah.
Your goat meat, it's butchered locally, it's sold fresh.
We take the kids to the abattoir at 9 to 12 months and brought back into local butchers into Cambridge where they are hung for 2-3 days as a minimum and then portions into racks of ribs, some steaks, neck fillets, roasting joints for legs and shoulders.
We also keep some of the liver.
Sometimes we're allowed to keep back the stomachs and the livers. Kidneys and hearts.
Yeah, kidneys.
Yeah, but that's normally reserved for our private customers because it's really popular. People love it, especially the liver. It's very nice flavour.
Mm.
Yeah. Really
nice. Now, the other thing is the other products like processed foods. I mean, we'd looked at things like sausages, burgers. There's a gentleman, the butchers in Cambridge, called Art of Meats. He's done some very beautiful burgers for us. The Art of Meat, I think, is really an artist with meat, isn't it?
Yeah. It's got the correct name for the shop, for the butchers. He's very good at it.
Yeah.
Really good.
There's another gentleman who is doing a lot of work on smokes.
It's dry cured goat legs that he's trying to turn into goat violin meat, which is something that's very popular in Italy.
Yeah.
I think it's called goat violin meat because you hold it like it's a violin, the leg, and when you get the knife and cut it, it's like the bow of a violin.
I see.
I think that's where it comes from. It takes 6 weeks, so yeah.
So we're going a lot more for the processed meat, so really adding value to the meat. Someone called it a niche product. We're not going to do it mass commercial scale, but enough to hopefully satisfy the demand of the clients.
Just to describe the flavour of goat meat in your own words.
Gosh. Well, I would describe it as kind of a deep, gamey lamb flavour. It's very rich, but once it's treated nicely in the kitchen, you know, tender cooking, it's a really lovely, lovely meat. I wish more people would try it.
And tender is the key word here.
Tender's the key.
The meat from kids It's high in protein and iron, with apparently less than 40% saturated fat than chicken even. I presume that's chicken with the skin on. But the fat has flavour and is full of energy. So this is compensated for when you're cooking goat meat by cooking it slowly, by braising it to retain that flavour, not to reduce it.
Yes, I'll say that's quite right. But the goats that go to the butchers when they're kids still do have a lovely flavour. Mm. Tender, not too fatty, very good for steaks.
There's a waiting list for fresh. People want it fresh. That really is where the flavour is and the future of the business. You know? Maybe at one day, Anglia Farm Shop will be synonymous with good meat. That is a hope for the future. Yeah, you see the sign of a goat when you hear Anglia Farm Shop.
So John and yes. Melanie Onura and Sarah Chandler, thank you very much. You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. Thank you.
It's very nice of you to come. Thank you very much. Yeah?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anglia Goat Farm's goat meats are available at the Art of Meat in Arbury Court, as well as the farm's own website, angliafarmshop.co.uk. You can also follow them on Twitter, at Anglia Farm Shop.
And John and Melanie are very concerned about the ethical treatment of animals. Their goats are well looked after. They get plenty of love and affection, like Joan Armour Trading. Enough shelter, lots of extra food, carrots and parsnips, even blackberries.
Melanie referenced Story's Guide to Raising Meat Goats, which is a book, a Bible even, by Maggie Sayer. Don't buy a goat without this book, wrote one reviewer from the Ozarks.
And Anglia Farm Shop's website contains recipes for stews, casseroles and goat pie. Mm-hmm. They also supply ready meals and curry kits. Their home-reared goats eat meadow grass free of herbicides, pesticides, chemicals or fertilisers, and the animals are drug-free.
They also want to work with the industry when it comes to saving the billy goats, which, like rams and bullocks, are sometimes dispatched at birth. There's an initiative in Holland where dairy goat farming is a big industry, and billy goats are sadly a consequence of that. The initiative is attempting to turn things around, enabling male kids to be reared rather than put down at birth, by striking more of a balance between the ethical and commercial rearing of billy goats.
But Matt, after you visited this goat farm, how did you feel about goats being killed? Because they're such lovely animals.
Tasty.
Yeah, but
Ruth agrees.
Every animal is lovely. I come from a farm anyway. I spent many years on a farm, and we had sheep, and we had plenty of orphan lambs as well, and we regularly sent them to slaughter.
To their maker.
Yes, and that even included pet orphan lambs as well, you know. And
pet ones.
Yes, yeah. And you do get used to it. There is a disassociation. But I did speak with John, Melanie and Sarah about this. Mm. And yeah, they feel that as well. There is something, I don't know, maybe I'm just too harsh, but I was able to build up a brink between me and the
You're
pets.
A hard and brutal man, that's quite clear to me.
At Cambridge 105, we're proud to be out and about in our city. If you've got a local event coming up and you'd like us to be part of it, drop your details over to publicity@cambridge105.fm. Cambridge 105, the station that cares the most about the community.
And a quick tweet from Joe at the Black Bar Brewery in Harston. He's there brewing as we speak. And the brewery is open from 10 till 2. You can go down there and say hi. Smell the malty loveliness, he says, and you can also buy some of his bottled beers, which are very nice.
Sounds good. Rhode Island opened up in Cherry Hinton a little over a year ago, and when we interviewed Aksara in Dumnar before they opened, it was almost a completely different space to what it is now. So I caught up with her to see how it's been going.
I'm here with Aksara of Rhode Island, and you guys have been open a little bit over a year and a half now.
Yeah. Yeah,
how's it been going?
Yeah, good. Kind of things have changed a lot, so we're still sort of stuck to our core burgers, milkshakes, kind of craft beer, that sort of thing, but we also have the gallery space now. We do breakfast, brunch, open early in the mornings. Yeah, good.
So why has it changed so much? Was it just because of...
I think it just took a little bit of time to sort of nail the concept, to get on our feet, to kind of think, right, where are we going with this? I think, you know, when we opened, it was just kind of like a sudden opening, and we just sort of opened. We thought, let's see how it goes. It's been sort of like the hugest learning curve, sort of biggest experience of my life. And I think it's just one of those things where we've sort of thought, right, we've got some great stuff here, but it's sort of like, where do we go from now, and what else could we be doing? And it's just such a huge space, and it's such a creative space, and there's so much opportunity, and I think there's so much potential. We just kind of started thinking outside the box and just trying to make it a bit more how I wanted it to be in the first place, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Cool. So what exciting things are we looking forward to?
We've already started some of them. So we've got our live music sessions that we do fortnightly set up, and they're sort of every other Sunday. One of events where we had sort of stuff going on for our birthday weekend, we had kind of like temporary craft beer, sort of almost festival, I guess. And then we did our Eat Cambridge House Times Brewery event, which was craft burgers and beers. We've got something in the works for 4th of July, maybe sort of like an outdoor barbecue, teaming up with some other sort of local chefs, butchers, that kind of thing. Bacchanalia again, the craft beer. And then we've also got like our monthly pop-ups coming up. We've got, I can never ever pronounce it, Go Go Gooey.
Yeah.
I always just shorten it. I always just say go go. So we've got them scheduled to come in next month. And then we've got Janan Jalan to make an appearance in July. A bunch of arts and crafts workshops. We had Adele doing bookbinding. Adele Hopkin, and then we have crafty workshops coming up, make your own bath bomb, scented candles, clay trinkets, things like that. And then we've got obviously the changing exhibitions every sort of 4 to 6 weeks. So there's a lot kind of in the woodwork at the moment. We're also in the process of renovating our garden, so we'll be using the outdoor bar, doing a lot more events out there, kind of cocktail evenings, things like that. Lot going on, I think, at the moment.
That's really good. What's the thing you're most looking forward to in the next couple of weeks?
Probably, to be honest, the monthly pop-ups. I think that's obviously a really, really exciting and new thing happening here. And I think it would be nice to just work with and promote sort of other local street food vendors and kind of offer our customers something different once a month. And we're wanting to make it more than just your traditional pop-up, so more than just eating and just having sort of the people come and take over the kitchen, I guess. So we're wanting to work together to do, with Gogo, for example, we're doing like Korean-inspired cocktails as well, so we'll be doing a cocktail menu to go along with the food menu. We're trying to get a Korean pop band or something, so try and make it more of an event and like something, you know, to really go out and do, more of sort of an evening as opposed to just kind of like pop up.
You have got Hot Numbers Coffee as your coffee,
yes.
And I know Stella provides some of her brownies.
So yeah, that's right.
What other local people do you have?
Probably most of them, to be honest. So we do Teas. We also stock a bunch of Adelia's breads, her famous Portuguese custard tarts, sort of chocolate croissants, things like that from Norfolk Street Bakery. Then we do the gourmet mallows, Bacchanalia's our primary beer supplier. We do some stuff from Jolly Good Beer, who's also quite local.
Oh, well, I'm glad to see you doing so well. I'm looking to see how much more it evolves in
the
next year or so. Let us keep us updated.
Yeah, definitely will do.
Cool, well, thank you very much, Aksara.
Thank you.
Aksara has some really fun ideas, and I think it's great she uses so many locals. After all, we have such a bevy, why wouldn't you? I'd like to see what the next year brings. You can bet I'll be there for that Korean pop-up, especially if they have Korean pop.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
And a few episodes ago, we ran a feature on Thomas Hobson, the very well-known Cambridge man who was also a publican. And he was in the 16th century. His name was given to Hobson Street, Hobson's Choice, and so on. The feature was about life in a Cambridge pub, and the historian Matt spoke to had lots more interesting information about beer and ale from that era that we just couldn't pass up on a food and drink programme.
Good afternoon. My name is Matthew Ward. I'm a historian, and I specialise in making history rather more fun and interesting than a lot of dusty people would rather like to do. And I particularly like using food and drink from history to introduce people into past times. And the Tudor times was a wonderful time for food and drink. Lots of new spices and flavours were coming in from countries across the world, including India, for the first time trading with them. We'd opened up trade routes with Russia and with Arabia, so these new flavours came in. but also from Europe as well. And one of the big changes in Tudor England was the change from brewing ale to brewing beer. A rather subtle difference, you may think, but the two words, although they're used to mean the same thing today, for example, organisations such as CAMRA, the Campaign for Real Ale, use the word ale for what the Tudors would call beer. And the difference is down to two things: the method by which it was made and the method by which it was preserved. Ale is the old process for making a drink that goes all the way back to, goodness me, several thousand years, and it involves warming the liquid, warming the mash up. So you'd start with a big vat of your mash with your ground grains in it. You take out a cauldron full, warm that up, pour that into the large vat, take out another cauldron, warm that up, and you gradually increase the temperature. And so the mash never really gets truly hot. Because of this, the amount of malt that's extracted from the grain is relatively low, and because it was never boiled, it would never keep for very long. And so ale had to be made and drunk very, very fresh. But the big change came about when hops started to be imported into England in the reign of Henry VIII. And hops, as well as adding a great flavour to beer, they also are a preservative. They're antibacterial, and they kill all the bugs in the beer and allowed it to be made in larger batches and preserved for longer. At the same time, the brewing process changed from being this gradual warming through process used for traditional ale to being the same process we use today, where you malt the barley and then the liquid is completely boiled, brought up to the boil. And this made a huge difference because it killed any microorganisms that were in the beer, so it made it safe to drink, and the hops allowed you to preserve it and transport it in large quantities from major brewing centres. So brewing changed from being a cottage industry where almost every household, every cottage would make their own ale, to being an industry. One of the great centres of brewing in England, which still is today, is Burton-upon-Trent, absolutely synonymous with brewing. And the brewing industry in Burton-on-Trent came about because of the intrigues during the reign of Queen Elizabeth. Because one of the local residents in that area was a lady of some notorious name, Marie Stuart, Queen of Scots. And she was held in captivity in a castle called Tutbury Castle on the crags and hills above Burton-on-Trent. And she wasn't alone. She had a large entourage there. So although she was a prisoner, it wasn't held in solitary confinement in a cell. She was just held within the area of the castle. And this large entourage needed a lot of beer because water wasn't safe to drink unless you had a very, very sure supply of water. And the castle is up on a high, rocky crag above the village. And it does have a well, but the well does not produce enough water to produce the beer required for an entourage of several hundred people. And so a brewing centre was established in Burton. This was further compounded by her intrigues. Because beer was being brought into the castle, she was using the beer barrels to smuggle messages in and out. But her jailer, a man called Paulette, got wind of this and stopped that and intercepted all the messages. And this led eventually to Marie Stuart's downfall. So messages smuggled in barrels of beer from the new brewing industry in Burton led to the downfall of Marie Stuart and, effectively, the launching of the Spanish Armada. And so the intrigues of Tudor England revolved ultimately around brewing, which is quite an intriguing thought.
Many thanks to historian and broadcaster Matthew Ward for that detailed explanation. Matthew worked on three series of Horrible Histories and was the historian for the new BBC film Testament of Youth. If you'd like to know more about him, you can visit the website historyneedsyou.com or Twitter at historyneedsyou.
Join me, Phil Rowe, for Sunday breakfast from 8 till 11 for some relaxing music, interviews with local people, newspaper and sports reviews, and the now legendary Cambridge Quiz. A great way to start your Sunday. Community radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105. We're here live in the studio. There's many ways to contact us. You can text us on 07919 070490. We're available on Twitter at Flavour105, or you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.fm.
Andrew Webb, who we recently heard, has put on such a fantastically porky night at the Pint Shop as part of the Eat Cambridge Festival, has been looking at mentions of Cambridge in two volumes from his historical bookshelves.
Hello, welcome to the Historical Bookshelf with me, Andrew Webb. Now, the month of May sees my birthday. I hit the big 4-0 this month, hooray! And so, by way of a sort of little treat, I've got not one book from my bookshelf today, but two. And the first one here is Guide to Good Food Shops by Susan Campbell. And much like my own book, Food Britannia, this is her kind of tour around Britain, looking for good food shops and that sort of thing. And I've picked this one because this was published in 1979 by Macmillan. And it sort of shows us perhaps how far we've come, bearing in mind I was born in 1975. So the entries for Cambridge are particularly interesting. There is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That's it. 8 good food shops in Cambridge. That's it. In the 70s. But of particular interest is this one. Arjuna, 12 Mill Road. A group of about 15 Cambridge graduates, full-time workers, have organised themselves into a workers' cooperative and take turns in the day-to-day running of the shop, which sells, amongst other things, whole foods, radical literature and aids to self-sufficiency. There we go, radical literature. If this sounds boringly familiar, which it is, take heart. One recommender says, I was suspicious of this trendy-looking health food shop when it opened in the 1960s, with whole ladies in long spun skirts. But though it seems somewhat a little unmaterialistic, the quality is always excellent. A quick turnover ensures freshness, and they sell the best range of dried fruits and beans I know. And as you may know, Arjuna is still there today. It's been trading now for 40 years, and it's still going strong. There's a little bit on their website here that says here, and so here we are, after decades of trading, Arjuna is still here, 40 years on, despite today's climate of supermarket dominance and increasing losses of small independent shops. The cooperative members today might not have long hair and beards, but their hippie-ish motivations of old are still central to our daily decisions. Well, there you go. And of course, Fitzbillies is in here, now owned, of course, by Tim Hayward. But I'll just read you quickly the entry on that. It's got a super bakery which specialises in croissants and Vienna-type gâteaux and chocolate cakes. Chelsea buns are something of a speciality in this old-fashioned bakery, and you know Tim has kept that going. But I like this final line. All bread and confectionery is made on the premises daily. Some of it is traditional, and some of the things the shop stocks are out of the ordinary. And the final sentence, they will make posh cakes and big orders if warned. So there you go. If you want a posh cake, you have to warn Tim if he's keeping with tradition on that score. And that's it. So that's a kind of interesting one there. Now, my second book is The Good Food Guide by Raymond Postgate. Some of you may remember he founded The Good Food Guide. And this is a book that I got for my birthday off my sister, actually. And this is the completely new edition, 1965 to 1966. So if we looked out on good food shops in the 70s, let's see what passed for good food in restaurants in the 60s in Cambridge. So here we are, we're on page 124. We haven't really got a lot, really. There's the Arts Restaurant, which is next to the Arts Theatre. It says it's fairly good, fairly cheap food. Members have enjoyed salmon salad, gammon with pineapples and Chateaubriand steak and roast duckling. There you go. The schnitzels, however, have found to be tough and the vegetables and coffee are not to be recommended. So there's that. But my other favourite one here is the Bath Hotel. I think this is now just a pub. It's on Bennett Street. And it's still there, I think. This is a pub now. There is a good choice of table d'hote here, a quite extensive a la carte menu. The cooking depends largely upon Mr. Kinsey himself, and a certain lapses may be due to his absence. Dishes to be recommended include eggs, argentuil, fried lemon soles, roast beef and roast duck. On the a la carte, one guest was defeated by the size of his mixed grill. So there you go. it does tail off a bit, though. Fresh cream and homemade mayonnaise are used, but some members have been disappointed in the vegetables and the hors d'oeuvres and cheese board have been much criticised. There's a few other bits and bobs. La Jardin, that's on 17 Hills Road. That's now sesame, actually, a kind of Thai Thai place. So that's there, but we've got, that's all the classic things, biscomenage, soup d'oignon, pâté de foie gras, escargot, ratatouille, quenelles, blah, 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 French, basically. Miller's Wine Parlour, anyone remember that? Get in touch if you do. And then our final entry in our town for what passes for good food is the Turk's Head, 14 Trinity Street. This typical Burnie restaurant is not remarkable, but it is above the general local level and is recommended for its steaks and chicken. And so there you go. There are two good books there, one from the 60s, one from the 70s, outlining a kind of potted history of the shops and restaurants of our town. And it's great to see that some things, like Arjuna and Fitzbillies, have stayed the same, but other things have totally, totally changed, like the dominance of French cuisine and... or the demise of the Burnie Inn on Trinity Street there. If you think about how far we've come in certain respects, and how nowadays, you know, health foods and that sort of stuff is not the obscure, radical, weird hippie thing it once was, but now it's probably a bit more mainstream, actually. And how... you know, you're seeing places like Pint Shop and other places and Steak and Honour kind of get back to perhaps the mixed grill and the a kind of quality meat-led place rather than the sort of Burnie Inn version. Can you still get a good mixed grill in Cambridge? Do let me know. But that's it for this month on the Historical Bookshelf. With this sort of looking here at the sort of French history of dining in the city, I think next month we're going to be looking at fine dining and some of the French classics and maybe look at what Midsummer House do. So that's all to come next month on the Historical Bookshelf. Until then, au revoir.
And that was Andrew Webb on piano. Nice to hear about Arjuna's beginnings there, I thought. Interesting.
Yeah, and you really get a feel of how limited the restaurant scene was in those days. How on earth did you manage?
We didn't. Things were not good, but you didn't realise it till you went abroad, really, you know, and ate proper food. And on the subject of proper food or good food, Jax Gelato is coming to Relevant Records Cafe and is there today. Ice cream and all sorts of things, gelatos. So... that's just been tweeted.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Pinot Noir, the grape, accounts for 38% of the Champagne region's vine planting. And Alice Archer, she's a wine advisor to the Cambridge Wine Merchants, has sliced the cork off a champagne bottle with a sword, you know, just like you're supposed to, a spoon... and very possibly a thin, sharp-edged mobile phone. Matt put on his best Errol Flynn costume, and he does look good in that, last Thursday, and headed off to the wine merchants where street food vendors Steak and Honour were about to make their weekly appearance.
So it's pretty meaty on the nose, but then very rich on the palate. Really robust, very rounded. Usually, if there's more Chardonnay in a champagne, you get more lemony notes, whereas these are deeper fruits, almost a bit blackcurranty, actually.
I think it's quite understated. I think it's very smooth.
Very smooth.
Yes.
Very smooth indeed. No, really nice drinker, this one.
Mmm.
Pinot Noir, simply put, is wine for the hedonist, but most importantly, for the adventurous, not the conventional. The variety in vines, clones, soils, growing conditions, and the fickle nature of this capricious grape variety all add up to a unique and unpredictable experience in every bottle, from every region, every year. There's nothing textbook about it, which leads to judgment entirely based on personal pleasure, the hedonist dream. Pinot Noir, though, is the aristocrat among vines. It's fastidious, it's shy, but it's also one of our most historic grape varieties. The grape variety accounts for some of the most highly prized and priced wines in the world. But as a variety, it's weak, highly susceptible to disease, and genetically unstable, so prone to mutation. A few examples of Pinot mutation include Pinot Meunier from Champagne, Pinot Blanc, better known in Alsace, and Pinot Gris, otherwise known as Pinot Grigio in Italy.
So what do you mean by mutation?
A mutation is... it's a sort of clonal development, essentially. Pinot vines tend to die quite young, and so it's when cutting and grafting isn't quite fully carried out and a slightly different variety grows. There are marginal differences, but there are up to 1,000 supposedly different Pinot Noir mutations across the world.
Just briefly, there was something else there you said about the ease with which the grapes die off and yes. the thinness or the thickness of the grape yes. skin.
Yeah, they're very thin-skinned grapes, and so they want a cool climate, not too cold, so otherwise they won't ripen properly. Anything too hot, they'll ripen too early, the thin skins will break and diseases will come along. Too damp, again, the skins will break and you'll get disease, and so it's tricky and fickle variety to grow. Great care is involved in Pinot production. So, as I said, Pinot Noir is perhaps one of the oldest grape varieties known to man. It's, in fact, thought to be one of the first refinements from the wild vines. There are historical sources that show that Pinot Noir may well have been cultivated around the Burgundy area as far back as when the Romans invaded Gaul in the 1st century AD. The works of Pliny seem to have recorded this. There's also possible evidence of Pinot Noir's existence in Burgundy in the 4th century. So the first concrete written record of the variety and the name, uniquely, is in 1375. And just 20 years later, Philip the Bold, Duke of Burgundy, issued an edict, in fact banning the inferior Gamay variety from an area known as the Côte d'Or in favour of Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir is so steeped in history. No other grape variety has held the same name and repute for 6 centuries, let alone plausibly 2 millennia. So there are 290,000 acres of Pinot Noir now planted the world over, and 75,500 of those are in France. Surprisingly enough, for the English market, 73,500 are actually the USA, although we don't get to see much. And the third highest grower is Germany with 29,000. The famous New Zealand comes in at just 10,500. And South Africa down at 2,500 acres.
And Chile is quite small as well.
Chile's remarkably small, yeah, 7,000 acres. Whereas Trillium Pinot Noir we perhaps see more of in the UK.
Is that simply because of fashion and taste that this is something that... Do you recognise that it's growing?
As in Pinot Noir?
Chilean Pinot Noir, for example.
I think there is growth in Chilean Pinot Noir. Chile itself, as a wine region, is really expanding. It's a unique country. I can't remember how many miles, but it's just long and thin, and they're expanding their wine-growing areas further south, so it'll be a much cooler climate, much more suitable for Pinot growing. Pinot Noir attracts a wilder bunch, a self-indulgent crew of men and women who love flavour, who love perfume, who love the silky tactile experiences of a wine like Pinot. Seductive, sultry, steamy, sinful if possible, but always solely there, solely made to give pleasure. I thought that might be a bit too much for the audience.
Oh, he does go for it.
He absolutely goes for it. I know, I was just like, this is a really mundane book everywhere else. And then suddenly we got into Pinot Noir and just, I don't know, that Moss Clark. Yeah, so tonight, street food legends Steak and Honour have just pulled up to serve their rapidly becoming famous burgers alongside a small pop-up tasting. We do this every Thursday. Tonight's a bit more special as I'm focusing just on one of my favourite grape varieties and because it has so much variety, so hopefully we'll find a nice food match for everyone here. A nice experience, learn a bit more about the wines they're drinking, taste a few things, and enjoy some excellent food.
So educate and masticate.
Educate and masticate. That is the motto of the of the evening, it seems.
I think street food is becoming very popular at the moment, and I think, you know, it works in harmony with Cambridge Wine Merchants. I think they're doing really well out of it. Great buzz every Thursday. You know, it's a great place to come. I really look forward to Thursdays. I love coming here, getting my Steak and Honour and, you know, getting a little quick drink. It's great.
We came here because we live nearby and we decided to have a burger with a glass of wine. And our daughter loves the burgers here. And
it's such a lovely evening as well.
It's lovely.
So what can beat a nice glass of wine, nice burger and, yeah.
Blanc de Noir, because we're tasting Pinot Noir today. This is majority Pinot Noir, a bit of Pinot Meunier as well, but it's white and it's busy. Maybe.
I come here actually quite regularly for all the wine. They have absolutely delicious and fabulous wine, and the hosts here are very good at telling you about the different kinds and types.
Could I try the Italian?
The Italian,
as I know this one and this one and this one, I think.
Perfect. So, Pinot Nero. Just one, I think.
Yeah, so I love coming to the Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton. They've got always a nice, interesting pop-up. Tonight is Steak and Honor. I've had their classic burger. Love it. And paired it really nicely with a Abruzzo Sangiovese red wine. Fantastic.
Hello.
Hi.
You like to try some Pinot Noir?
Sure.
Excellent.
And we've been before where there'll be perhaps Spanish wines on. We don't come every week, but every now and then somebody will send the text round saying, I'm going. Anybody else want to come? And we just see who turns up, really. So it's not a regular thing, but it's like every now and then we just kind of think, well, it's about time we had another burger and a drink. So this is the place to come, really.
It's our local, isn't it? It's our local. It's really nice.
There you are, that'll do.
Fortunately, I don't really come here for the burgers because I'm a vegetarian, but I have heard of their beautiful vegetarian option now by your kind self tonight.
And I'm a vegetarian, and I know they do a shroom burger, and it's really nice. It's a great big portobello mushroom.
I definitely come here because they've got a very wide variety of choice of different wines, but specifically I like the zero dosage champagnes that they have, which is actually quite rare to find anywhere else.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Mm. Blimey.
Quaffable.
Yes, that's the word.
Quaffable in the evening sunshine outside.
You are heading down that Jancis Robinson-y route already, aren't you?
Steak and Honour appear every Thursday at the Cambridge Wine Merchants on Cherry Hinton Road. With plenty of outdoor and indoor seating, it's a nice venue to spend an evening matching fine wine with an extremely well-regarded burger.
Mm. Well, there are all sorts of interesting programmes here on Cambridge 105. At 1 o'clock today, for example, Mandy Morton's here with her gardening programme, which includes a feature on getting to grips with an allotment. And the next edition of Flavour in 2 weeks' time is followed by Lee Chambers with Bookmark, and that programme will be featuring the writer Lizzie Collingham. She is a research fellow at Jesus College, and Lizzie's new book, which I was looking at in Waterstones the other day, is about curry, well, the history of curry, really. And here's part of her conversation with Lee Chambers.
In the early days, the British enthusiastically embraced curries and they loved their curries and so on in the late 18th, early 19th century. And then gradually, as time went on and they saw themselves in India as bringing a new form of rule, a kind of proper, upright Englishman bringing the rule of law and education and civilization to India, this is how they saw themselves, then they didn't think it was appropriate anymore to eat Indian food. So they started to adopt a weird approximation of English food, what they could manage to cook in India, and rejected Indian food. And that became a sort of subsidiary thing that you might eat in the club on a Sunday for lunch, or that you could have maybe on the lunch table at home, but you wouldn't serve at a dinner party and so on. That's how I sort of became interested in Indian food, and that's where the book that the research that curry grew out of was out of that.
And do you think you can trace the history of a nation through food?
I think food is a really good tool for a historian, and I'm very much a historian first and foremost who uses food as a way of getting at interesting ideas. With curry, you do get a sort of potted history of India, but it does bring people who wouldn't sit down to read a history of India. They do acquire all kinds of knowledge about the history of India without even sort of even noticing or trying. So it is a good way to engage people and to write about all kinds of complex historical issues without people feeling taxed by it. Yes, so I think you can write some sort of a history of a nation, not a comprehensive full history of a nation, of course, through food. I think it is a very good way of getting at historical issues from a different angle. So when I wrote the history of food during the Second World War, I didn't really start knowing where I was going to end up, but I was surprised to be taken to all kinds of places by food, and it made me look at the Second World War in, I hope, a new and refreshing way. And I like that about food, that it allows you to look at something very familiar and well-worn and allows you to get at different angles of it and different perspectives and look at things in a new way. So I'd really like food as a tool for the historian.
And you said that the British, the English, adapted Indian food to their own taste. Is that still the case now? When we go into an Indian restaurant here, are we seeing a British version of what Indians eat rather than actually experiencing the real thing? Because I know you've been to India many times.
People often ask me, is it authentic if they go to an Indian restaurant? And then the problem is, what is authentic Indian food even in India? Because after all, India doesn't really have a national cuisine. There isn't one repertoire set of dishes that you could say all people in India would know, recognise, cook and eat happily. The British adapted, took on and enjoyed lots of dishes, and of course all over India, the different regional dishes. Even then, even when they lived in India, their cooks would have adapted them to their tastes. And so you can see that in recipes for korma, for example. The recipe for korma, which you might cook for a Mughal emperor, if you're cooking it for the British, much less rich, much less ghee. Whenever the British eat Indian food, whether it was here or in India, it was adapted. The point about Indian restaurants is they were started mainly by Bangladeshis who had jumped ship in the 1940s. So these men were quite often boiler men. They worked in the boiler rooms, and that's a horrible job on the steamship. And they came from Sylhet, an area which is in now Bangladesh, and they weren't really cooks at all. But they set up little restaurants and cafes to cook the food that was familiar to them for other sailors who were in the ports and so on, and then bought up bombed out curry and fish and chip shops in the 1940s, and they slowly started the tradition of the Indian restaurants. So they cooked the kind of weird curries that would have been familiar to them on board the ship. And then also then there were one or two restaurants at the time that were set up for Anglo-Indians, and they cooked a sort of northern Indian Mughal version of dishes and Punjabi food, and it's sort of a modified and adapted, not just for the British taste, but also for serving easily and quickly in an Indian restaurant. So you get the advent of boiled onion paste. So you'd boil down tons and tons of onions, and then you'd use that as your basic paste to which you add your spices and so on. And then from there, you make all the various dishes that you're going to serve. And that's a kind of restaurant adaptation. What you eat in an Indian restaurant is a very strange coming together of a variety of different traditions, but it's not something that an Indian necessarily would eat in their homes. And quite often, men who would come out and work as waiters in these restaurants in the 60s and 70s would look at the food they were serving, and they wouldn't even recognise it as something that they would think of as food that they would eat at home. Certainly quite a lot of them wouldn't have dreamt of eating it. That's not to say that you wouldn't find that kind of food anymore in India. You will find it now in India. I've been doing research on food at the Rashtrapati Bhavan. That's the president's house, which was the viceroy's house in New Delhi. And I was served there for lunch butter chicken, which is a kind of standard restaurant-style meal. So that's something you will get now in India, and Indians will eat it at home and so on. So it's a big mixture and a big exchange of styles and dishes, and that's always been going on ever since the Europeans first arrived in India, and it will carry on going on, I should imagine, until we give up on Indian food, which is very unlikely.
And what about the names? Where do the names come from? Did you have any success with that?
We'll say something like dopiaza, the Mughals will eat it, and it tends to refer to things with lots of onion in and so on. That's a standard. Balti is supposed to refer to a kind of, it's supposed to mean bucket, but it's a kind of dish. And chicken tikka masala, well, tikka is just because what you do with it when you're going to put it in the tandoori. Masala is spice mix. It's just describing a dish. Indian dish names, actually, tend to be very, very descriptive. So aloo, gobi, just means potato. cauliflower, isn't it? And we don't realise that. Murgi masala, quite often they mean emperor's chicken or whatever. And we think they sound terribly fancy, but they just mean
just as we're
chicken in a white sauce.
Yeah. Are you surprised by how popular Indian food is in this country? Because it's quite different to what we would think of as traditional British cuisine.
No, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, I think the British have had a really long relationship with India. I mean, in the early days, in the Mughal period, when the first sort of British people went out there to persuade the emperor to give them a trading dispensation, the food that these Englishmen ate at the Mughal court was very familiar to them. It was the same kind of stuff they were eating at home. So very heavily spiced, medieval, kind of almond-based dishes with rose water in and pounded chicken and so on. The English used to eat something like Mughal food in the medieval period. It's not totally unfamiliar to English taste buds to eat that kind of food again. English food did become terribly bland and boring, so it must have been incredibly interesting and exciting to have these dishes coming in. I mean, we are real magpies. We will just pick and choose whatever we pick up. Our own cooking is so bland and boring that we amalgamate and incorporate all kinds of different ways of cooking. So, no, I don't think it's surprising at all. I think it's a very English tendency to pick things up.
And Indian food itself is the product of other people coming into the country,
yes,
and putting their influence on.
Yeah, Mughal food is partly a mixture of what they found in North India, very spicy food, and Central Asian and Persian traditions coming in with the Muslims. Portuguese obviously brought it. I mean, lots and lots of foods which we think of as essential to Indian cooking, like potatoes, tomatoes, cauliflower, spinach, they're not indigenous in any way to India, and they were all brought in and introduced by the Europeans, mainly by the Portuguese, the Dutch, and later on the British. And so Indian food is the same. It will absorb influences and then reproduce and make them into something distinctively Indian. That's what all countries tend to do, and some do it more successfully than others, and I think India does it beautifully.
And one last question. When you go to an Indian restaurant, what do you order?
You know, I have to let you just think, I don't go to an Indian restaurant very often. I like anything that I see on the menu that looks unusual, or the chef special, or something regional. That's what I go for. I'm not really very fond of chicken tikka masala or any of those, or, you know, the standard biryani or anything like that. I will always go for something that looks as though it's slightly more unusual.
Thank you, Lizzie. I've been very hungry now.
So am I. And you can hear all of the interview that Lee Chambers did with Lizzie Collingham on Bookmark at 1 o'clock on the 13th of June here on Cambridge 105.
On to the food and drink news now. There's none from the university this week. That's because it's exam time.
But plenty of news from the city. A new Thai restaurant is opening up the quayside on the 5th of June, specialising in Bangkok street food, and it's called Tycoon. Or perhaps I haven't pronounced it correctly.
The next Mill Road Feast is on the 7th of June from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. in the Gwydir Street car park. Amongst the providers will be Dynamic Organic. You can hear Rosie Sykes interviewing the man behind it, Tyler Cotton, on one of our recent podcasts. Also, there will be the OOO Company, who will be selling their olive oil.
You can get drinks from Bejo Bebidas, The Juice Box and Benissimo, street food from Steak and Honour, Fired Up Pizza, vegan samosas from Cadwin Curries. There's also the Duke of Pork, Chili Pot, Goulash Valley, Number 12 Village Shop and Deli, and we hope the Wandering Yak selling vegan and vegetarian foods.
Yeah, and if that's not enough, there's also Jack's Gelato, Chiro's Bar, Puffetier's. That's the Mill Road Feast. It's on the 7th of June from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Inda's Kitchen has a new lunchtime menu and a new very clear website which you can order from, and their barbecue menu can be found there too, extensive and delicious sounding.
Annabelle and Jamie have another pop-up next month. It's a Spanish tapas and matching wines evening at Sticky Beaks in Hobson Street. That's on the 26th of June from 7:45 until 10 p.m. Tickets are from Eventbrite, and the menu is mixed Spanish charcuterie, tortilla, which is a classic Spanish omelette served with alioli, piquillo peppers stuffed with bonito del norte tuna, albóndigas, which is Spanish meatballs made with lamb and pork, a selection of Spanish cheeses, chocolate and Seville orange petit fours. The introductory drinks are £10, the food is £20, and the matching flight of three wines is £12.50.
There's to be a Mill Road Night Market. It's taking place on the 18th of July from 6 till 10pm. There'll be food and entertainment.
Some courses coming up soon at the Cambridge Cookery School. On Tuesday, Kitchen Classics, an intensive four-hour course beginning with knife skills, then moving on to classic sweet and savoury sauces and pastry. Next Saturday from 10 till 2, classic sauces, and next Sunday is a beginner's bread class. That's the Cambridge Cookery School, and you can book via their website.
And there's some tasty-looking bin ends at Noel Young Wines in Trumpington, more than 50% off some of them.
And finally, next Friday marks the first anniversary of Food Park. It doesn't seem like a year since it began.
No, it doesn't, does it? And it's going from strength to strength too. Well done to Heidi White. Food Park anniversary celebrations take place next Friday, 11:30 till 2:30 in Station Road.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Flavour. We hope you enjoyed it, and if you really liked it, you can listen all over again tomorrow at 7am. It will also be available as a podcast in a few days' time, and you'll be able to find that on the Cambridge 105 website in the podcast section, along with all of our previous episodes. Or you can search for Flavour and subscribe to us in iTunes. We're also available on the Radio Player app.
Remember that you can keep in touch with Cambridge food and drink news by following Flavour on Twitter, at Flavour105.
Coming up next on Cambridge 105 is Mandy's Garden Shed, which is a rose special this month. Peter Jackson joins Mandy Morton to select some favourite blooms and look at some of the problems that beset rose growers. Also, Mandy and Nicola are back on the allotment for more planting, a shrew funeral, and a blow-by-blow account of a new shed. Was it a shed load of fun or an unmitigated disaster? Find out in a few minutes.
And that's followed by Summer Saturday, which is out and about at various events in Cambridge.
At 5pm, Trevor Dan returns with Cambridge Minds. His guests are Nikki Padfield, senior lecturer in Cambridge University's law faculty, former barrister and a judge, and now the master of Fitzwilliam College, and Bill Thompson, digital technology journalist, broadcaster, pundit, philosopher and consultant. And at 6pm, it's Jason Allen.
So until Saturday the 13th of June, that's all from Flavour. Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.
Bye.